Welcome to the Modern Federalist. Your compass in the world of politics, policy, and people. We're here to challenge norms, question narratives, and offer balanced insight on pressing issues. Your host, Charlton Allen, is a seasoned analyst and a staunch advocate for freedom. With his sharp intellect, he'll guide you through the maze of contemporary politics. Whether you're a political enthusiast or just a curious observer, you've found your haven. This is the Modern Federalist. Welcome to the revolution.
Welcome to the Modern Federalist Podcast. I'm Charlton Allen, and today we've got an exciting lineup of segments that cut through the noise and dive deep into critical issues. Buckle up, because we're about to rock, roll, and explore the heart of the matter. In our first segment, we dissect President Biden's tax claims from his State of the Union address. The media often falls short when it comes to scrutinizing these claims, but fear not. Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute sets the record straight. Let's separate fact from fiction and shed light on the truth. You will find Chris's insightful commentary in our episode notes. Next up, we'll delve into the complexities of the low-income housing tax credit. Don't be fooled by its seemingly benign name. There's much more to this credit than meets the eye. Chris Edwards is back in the spotlight, guiding us through the intricacies. Let's explore the policy landscape and uncover what lies beneath. Our third segment takes us to the heart of the Texas immigration litigation, specifically SB4. We'll dissect the Supreme Court order and navigate the subsequent legal ping pong that unfolded in the lower courts. Buckle up, it's a wild ride through legal twists and turns. In our fourth segment, I sit down with E.J. Antoni, a scholar from the Heritage Foundation. We'll tackle President Biden's claims about shrinkflation. Spoiler alert, it's not about shrinking goods. It's about the monetary and fiscal policies holding our nation hostage. Some elites have suggested cutting out bacon or cutting out breakfast altogether to cope with inflation. But with the $36 trillion debt that's growing faster than a speeding bullet, perhaps it's time to trim the fat, to trim the pork, if you will, and DC instead. And for those DC elites who suggest cutting out breakfast to cure our inflation woes, Marie Antoinette would be impressed by their PR skills. And that's not all. Stick around for my epilogue, a dash of parody, and a musical journey across different genres. The Modern Federalist Podcast is where we question, analyze, and groove. So let's kick it off. Let's go. In this segment, I want to dive into a fascinating piece from the Cato Institute written by Chris Edwards. In his recent State of the Union address, President Biden discussed raising taxes on the rich, claiming that they pay lower tax rates than firefighters or school teachers, or even that the rich pay a tax rate of just 8%. But is this really the case? Let's take a closer look. According to the White House, the average American worker paid about a 25% tax rate in 2022, while the wealthiest individuals paid about 8% from 2010 to 2018. However, this 8% figure seems to be at odds with data from the United States Treasury, the Congressional Budget Office, the Internal Revenue Service, and the Joint Committee on Taxation. Let's start with the Treasury data, which I will point out the Treasury Department is a part of the executive branch and therefore under President Biden's leadership. The tax rates are all federal taxes, whether income, payroll, excise, or other, then divided by family income. The top 1% will pay an average rate of 31.5% this year, compared with 10 to 12% for the middle income range and about 0% at the bottom. Now let's turn to the Congressional Budget Office data. The tax rates are federal income, payroll, and excise taxes and divided by household income. The average tax rate on the top 1% has hovered around 30% for four decades. So what does this all mean? Well, it seems the official data contradicts the White House's claims. The Treasury Department data, again from the executive branch, and the Congressional Budget Office data showed that federal tax rates at the bottom averaged about 0% or less. Tax rates in the middle averaged less than 15%, and rates at the top averaged around 30%. In other words, average tax rates at the top for the nation's top income earners are twice the tax rates for the middle income range. This is a far cry from the 8% figure touted by the Biden administration and the president himself in his State of the Union address. It's important to remember that facts and figures are crucial in shaping our understanding of the world. And as we've seen here today, sometimes the narrative presented isn't always in line with the actual data. Big hat tip to Chris Edwards and the Cato Institute for their insightful analysis and fact-checking of the Biden administration claims. Stay tuned for more fact-checking and in-depth discussions in today's episode and in future episodes to come. Welcome back, fellow freedom seekers. You're tuned in to The Modern Federalist, where we unravel the tangled threads of government intricacies. I'm Charlton Allen, your host and guide through this bureaucratic wilderness. Today, we're shining a spotlight, and a needed one, on the Federal Housing Tax Credit, a program that masquerades as a savior of affordable housing, but conceals a web of complexity that rivals a Gordian knot. Picture this, a grand theater, curtains parting to reveal a seemingly noble cause, housing for the needy. The Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, LIHTC, say that quickly five times. Its name evokes compassion, but its reality, it's a different tale altogether. Now let's crunch the numbers. The LIHTC showers $13 billion annually upon state governments, where, of course, they don't waste it, folks, who in turn play fairy godmother to their favored developers. But hold your applause. Beneath the surface lies a labyrinth of rules, regulations, and red tape that would make even Kafka raise an eyebrow. Let's start with the statute. Here, the LIHTC statute, which is tucked away cleverly and conveniently in the Internal Revenue Code, Section 42, spans a mere 59 pages. But wait, there's more. IRS regulations. There are 18 regulations on point, which total 181 pages, dissecting the program. Lawyers, sharpen your pencils. And then there are the IRS rulings. 18 revenue rulings in total, 101 pages strong, guide us through the LIHTC maze. Interpretation, anyone? IRS procedures. There are 17 revenue procedures, a concise 78 pages, which tell us how to apply the rules. They're riveting stuff, really. IRS notices. Between updates, calculations, and cryptic messages, there are 10 notices, only 82 pages, ancient scrolls decoded. Then, folks, there's the HUD guide. The Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, chimes in with a hefty 794-page guide on LIHTC occupancy requirements. Micromanagement, anyone? And then there's the IRS audit guide, a whopping 350 pages, ensuring no stone remains unturned. It's an insomniac's delight. Finally, there are other federal rules. A spattering of additional documents add another 474 pages. Why settle for a mere 2,060 when you can add a dash more complexity? And there you have it, my fellow citizens, the LIHTC. Not merely an investment incentive, much less a noble cause, but a central planning behemoth for our nation's apartment buildings. Who are the winners here? Well, fans of big governments. Paper companies, perhaps. Certainly lawyers savoring this bureaucratic feast, while well-connected real estate developers are clinking champagne glasses. But fear not, we will continue our exploration of bureaucratic morass in future segments. And before I depart this segment, a tip of the hat to Chris Edwards at the Cato Institute for his brilliant and well-researched insights on this topic, which I will include in the show notes. The moral of all of this is we have to stay vigilant, question authority, and when dealing with housing requirements, keep your tax code handy.
From sea to shining sea, this is the Modern Federalist Podcast, hosted by Charlton Allen.
In this segment, we're saddling up to discuss a pivotal moment in the ongoing immigration saga, the recent Supreme Court decision that gives Texas the green light to enforce its immigration law. So grab your Stetsons, because we're about to ride into the heart of the Lone Star State. Picture this, the Alamo, bathed in the Texas sun. Now imagine it is a legal battleground. The Supreme Court ruled that Texas can flex its immigration muscles while the state law is still waltzing through the lower federal courts. This law, known as SB 4, lets local law enforcement officers uphold the rule of law by apprehending illegal migrants who cross the border from Mexico. It's like Texas said, hold our beer. We're going to defend our law here. Now hold on to your hats, because this is where it gets interesting. Justice Sonia Sotomayor raised an eyebrow, or maybe her gavel, at this decision. She warned in her dissent that it could disrupt the delicate balance between the federal and state authorities. But let's consider this. Texas isn't just any state, it's a beacon of independence, a place where rugged individualism runs deep. Justices Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson joined the chorus of concern, but the majority, well, they're keeping their cards close to their vest, partner, respecting that Lone Star spirit. Now let's talk about the stakes. This isn't a high-stakes poker game, it's a battle for the soul of our nation. The chips on the table are the rights of every American citizen and every legal immigrant to our country. Texas knows this, and they're not playing games. They're standing firm. And let's be clear, local police enforcing immigration laws isn't about targeting illegal migrants, it's about safeguarding our communities. When officers uphold the law, they're protecting the very fabric of our society. So Texas can ride its immigration bronco for now, but don't hang your spurs up just yet. This litigation is still circling like a hawk, and the Supreme Court's decision isn't etched in stone. It's temporary. It's more like chalk on the saloon wall. The Supreme Court may ride in later like a low rider with the final decision and change the game. But for now, Texas stands tall, boots firmly planted in Lone Star soil, defending the principles that have guided us since the Founding Fathers. What does this mean for Texas and the nation? Well, Texas will keep its hat cocked and its boots dusty. Other states, they're watching this legal rodeo from the bleachers, taking notes. And as the sun sets over the Rio Grande, we'll wonder, is this a battle cry for a renewed emphasis on states' rights? Or just a Texas-sized skirmish in the larger war? Either way, it's a conversation that will echo from the plains of Austin to the halls of Congress. A reminder that liberty is not a spectator sport. So my fellow Americans, let's tip our hats to Texas. Whether you're sipping sweet tea on a porch swing or debating constitutional law, remember this decision matters. Texas isn't just a state, it's an idea, an unyielding commitment to freedom, sovereignty, and the American dream. Let's keep our eyes on the horizon, because in the land of liberty, every legal showdown is a chance to defend what we hold dear. And as the sun sets over the Rio Grande, let us echo the words of that old Texas anthem. The eyes of Texas are upon you. God bless Texas. God bless America. Welcome back. I wanted to give a quick update due to a twist in the Texas immigration saga. You see, while this episode was in post-production, the lower courts decided to join the dance floor once more. So consider this a bonus track, a legal encore, if you will. Here's the scoop. The lower court decided to put a hold on SB 4, the Texas immigration law that had everyone doing legal somersaults. This was after the Supreme Court's decision to allow the Texas government to continue to enforce SB 4. Governor Abbott of Texas, operating under the authority reserved to the states by our Constitution, is still taking matters into his own hands. Why, you may ask? Well, it's simple. The federal government's failure to enforce federal law effectively has created the situation. And now Texas is stepping up to the plate. Let's be clear, though. Our nation ceases to be a republic, a democracy, when the federal government executive authority cherry-picks which laws it enforces and which laws it does not enforce. It's a constitutional sleight of hand. In Texas, well, It's saying enough is enough. So once more, as before, as the legal sun sets over the Rio Grande, we must remember every step matters. Texas Governor Abbott isn't waiting around. He's operating independently of SB 4. And perhaps, just perhaps, the situation will be an inflection point. The federal government will take a long, hard, and needed look in the mirror. That said, I'm not holding my breath on that. Once more, God bless Texas and God bless America.
Well, howdy there, partner. Listen up. I got something to tell you. There's a new sheriff in town. It goes by the name of the Modern Federalist, hosted by Charlton Allen. It's the straight shooting, truth telling podcast you've been waiting for. So saddle up and join us on this ride.
This is the Modern Federalist podcast, hosted by Charlton Allen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Modern Federalist. I'm your host, Charlton Allen. Today we have a very special guest joining us. He's a renowned researcher, a thought leader, and a true advocate for sound fiscal policies. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. E.J. Antoni. Dr. Antoni is a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, where he dives deep into the intricate world of fiscal and monetary policy. His expertise extends across various domains, including markets, finance, and housing. But what truly sets him apart is his clear understanding of our nation's economy. You see, Dr. Antoni has been featured in some of the most prestigious news outlets, including The Daily Caller, Fox News, and The Wall Street Journal. His insights have graced the pages of The National Review, and he's been a sought-after guest on podcasts and radio programs. But it's not just about media appearances. Dr. Antoni has rolled up his sleeves and worked with think tanks and institutes, including the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, where he holds a senior fellowship. And let's not forget his time as an economist at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, a true testament to his commitment to advancing economic understanding. Without further ado, let's welcome Dr. E.J. Antoni to the show. Dr. Antoni, thank you for joining us. We're eager to learn from your wealth of knowledge.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've penned two recent commentary pieces that align closely with my views, pointing to Washington as the cause for inflationary pressures on our economy. And I wanted to dive deeply into those issues. In your article titled "Blame Washington, Not Grocery Stores for Food Prices," you argue that the Biden administration's policies are contributing to the current inflationary environment. Could you elaborate on that point and perhaps draw some parallels to other times in history when we've seen similar economic conditions?
Oh, I'd be happy to. The very short version of this is that the government has spent, borrowed, and created trillions of dollars it did not have for the last several years. And what that has done is it has devalued our currency. It has devalued the dollar. As they make more dollars, the dollars become less scarce, and they are making dollars much faster than the economy has been growing. So again, the value of the dollar is shrinking, and therefore it takes more dollars to buy something. It's not so much that things are worth more, fewer dollars. And that's just as true for food as it is for housing, as it is for automobiles, as it is for clothing or anything else that you buy. And so the idea that that the increase in food prices is caused by something else like corporate greed or some other boogeyman, I mean, it's absolute nonsense. And in fact, the Biden administration's own data proves it's nonsense, because their data show that prices paid by grocery stores for the things that they sell have gone up just as much as the prices that you and I pay for those things have gone up. The Biden administration has spent, borrowed, and printed trillions upon trillions of dollars that we didn't have over the last several years. And what that has done is it has devalued the dollar, because it has made the dollar less scarce and therefore diminished its value. As you create money faster than the economy grows, you cause this phenomenon of inflation, where it takes more dollars to buy something. It's not that the things you're buying are more valuable. It's that what you're using to buy them, the dollar, is losing value. And so it takes more dollars to buy something. Just like if I were to shrink the size of a yardstick, it takes more yardsticks to cover the exact same distance. And that's just as true for food as it is for housing and clothing and everything else you want to buy, whether it's a computer or an automobile. And so we have seen that in spades for the last several years. And we have seen this before, by the way. We saw this very prominently in the late 1970s and even into the early 1980s when the government was spending way beyond its means and the Federal Reserve was complicit in that spending by creating the money for Congress to spend. And sure enough, that was the last time you had inflation like we have seen during the Biden administration.
You have also noted that the calls for higher wages influence inflationary pressures. What are the potential long-term effects of this trend, and how does this compare to previous periods of high inflation and interest rates?
Well, we want to remember that this wage price spiral is not the cause of inflation. It is a symptom, meaning workers demanding higher wages does not cause inflation. If that was the case, then we would have inflation all the time because workers are constantly demanding higher wages. But they demand even higher wages, or those demands, I guess you could say, increase when you have periods of very high inflation and prices are rising quickly. So again, it is a symptom of inflation, but it is not the cause of inflation. Just like businesses don't cause inflation by raising prices, workers don't cause inflation by demanding higher wages. It is caused only by the government spending, borrowing, and printing much too much money. Now, the implications going forward here is that people still do not believe the Federal Reserve will get inflation back down to 2%, and for good reason. If we look at inflation over the last year and a half, 2 years, it has not been trending towards 2%. It has been trending towards a level over 3%, and we have arrived there, and there's no indication we're going any lower anytime soon.
What are the impacts of higher petroleum prices on inflation?
Well, higher oil prices are definitely going to cause prices throughout the economy to go up. And I think we really underestimate just how much energy prices affect everything we do and everything we buy. In an academic sense, that does not mean it's going to be inflationary in the sense that it's not the dollar losing value in this case that's causing prices to go up. It's a particular commodity that's causing prices to go up. However, for the typical American family, that kind of academic distinction is not really that valuable because it still means that they are poorer compared to before. It still means that their cost of living has gone up.
In the Biden administration, particularly in the president's recent State of the Union address, called for efforts to raise corporate taxes. Do you believe these efforts will affect the economy, particularly in terms of inflation?
It will certainly affect the economy. What we have seen repeatedly whenever we raise taxes on corporations is that those taxes simply get passed on either to shareholders in the form of lower returns, employees in the form of lower wages, or customers in the form of higher prices. There's also this misnomer that you can increase taxes on a person or a corporation. What you can increase is the tax rate, but then that person or corporation has to respond. And so you don't always get an increase in tax revenue when you increase the tax rate. It's frequently the opposite. You know, we saw this with the Tax Cuts and Job Act that was passed a few years ago, which reduced the tax rate, the top tax rate, on corporations and high income earners. But what was the result? Well, in the years following the passage of that act, the actual taxes paid by those groups went up, and only a couple of years later, it hit record highs. So again, the idea that you can somehow force people automatically to pay higher taxes, that's a misnomer. You can increase the tax rate, but then they get to respond to that.
And President Biden, particularly in his pre-recorded statements during the Super Bowl and afterwards, including in the State of the Union, has made comments about shrinkflation, a term that refers to the practice of companies subtly reducing the size of their products while maintaining the same price. What are your thoughts on this, and how does it contribute to the current inflationary environment?
This is nothing new. We're seeing it more frequently now because costs to businesses have risen so much. But the idea that somehow this is a brand new phenomenon just isn't true. Businesses have been doing this for literally decades. And whenever inflation picks up, they just do it more. But again, this idea that somehow shrinkflation is the cause of consumers' pain is silly. Shrinkflation is a symptom of the fact that the costs paid by businesses have risen so dramatically. They're up 18% in just the last 3 years. And so again, we're talking about symptoms here and not the cause. The cause goes back to government spending, borrowing, and printing much too much money. And both businesses and individuals alike are poorer because of it. You know, the Biden administration loves to talk about the fact that corporate profits are up, but they are up in the same sense that the average American's earnings are up as well. However, if you adjust both corporate profits and American earnings for inflation, what do you find? They've both gone down, not up.
And what about the suggestion that's been made by some of the elites of Washington that one cure to the inflationary pressures is to do something such as skip breakfast?
Oh, my goodness. It takes a true elite, someone who is completely removed from the economic ills experienced by the common man, to come up with so audacious and derogatory a suggestion as Americans can simply cut out a third of their calories and that will somehow solve all of their problems. No, the solution is not that Americans need to go on a diet. The solution is that the federal government needs to go on a diet. The fact of the matter is, as you increase the federal budget, you necessarily decrease the family budget. We have had much too much of that. It's time we had the reverse.
And do you have any final takeaways for our listeners on cures to the inflationary pressures on our economy and also what we need to do about some of the monetary and fiscal policies of the current administration and prior administrations in Washington?
Well, it's very clear, not just in the current administration, but what is commonly called the uniparty or the political establishment on both sides of the aisle, that the politicians are addicted to spending, which means the Treasury has to borrow. And that means the Federal Reserve is under political pressure to create the money to finance that borrowing. And that's how we've gotten into this absolute mess of inflation. Now, has it gotten a lot worse under the Biden administration? Absolutely. That's just what the data say. But the fact is, this problem has been going on for far too long, and the Biden administration simply gave it a violent shove into overdrive. We need to reverse all of the policies that got us here, both on the spending side and with the Federal Reserve creating so much money.
Indeed. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you.
The Modern Federalist, hosted by Charlton Allen, will return in a moment.
Howdy, Trailblazers. Welcome back to the Modern Federalist Podcast, where we ride the range of ideas like seasoned cowpokes. I'm your trusty guide, Charlton Allen, and today we are going to trek out to the untamed wilderness of the Antiquities Act. Hold on to your hats, folks, because this ain't your grandma's history lesson. Now let's rustle up some key facts. Since 2022, President Biden has wielded the Antiquities Act like a branding iron, creating five new national monuments. These patches of land stretch more than 1.5 million acres of federal territory. But here's the twist. These aren't just any old parcels. They're like the crown jewels of the American landscape. Or are they? They're not national parks or forests. but they were deemed protected by a stroke of a pen. Hold your horses, though. The American Forest Resource Council ain't sipping chamomile tea. They've hitched their wagons and galloped straight to the Supreme Court, hollering, "This antiquities at rodeo needs a reckoning." And can you name even one of these new monuments? I reckon most folks draw a blank faster than a tumbleweed in the dust storm. So what's the fuss here? The Antiquities Act, signed by Teddy Roosevelt back when dinosaurs still had saddle sores. No, Joseph Robinette Biden, I wasn't referring to you when I mentioned dinosaurs. Well, the Antiquities Act was meant to protect our heritage. Think things like ancient ruins, petroglyphs, and maybe even Teddy's secret stash of mustache wax. But here's the rub. Presidents can whip out this app faster than a gunslinger drawing a high noon. Oh, look over there, a pristine forest. Let's call it Biden's Bonsai Grove. And poof, it's protected. But what about the local loggers, miners, and farmers? They're left scratching their heads like a coyote with an itchy flea collar. By the way, who's seen a coyote with an itchy flea collar? I haven't. Here's the deal, folks. We want our heritage preserved, but not at the expense of local economies. It's like bacon and pie. You need the right ingredients. Judicial review here ensures presidents don't toss in jalapenos when the recipe calls for good old apple slices. It's time to wrangle that Antiquities Act like a wild bronco at a square dance. Let's keep our treasures intact without sacrificing the rule of law. So next time you're hiking in Biden's Bonsai Grove, tip your hat to accountability and say, "Thanks, Teddy. Let's keep it balanced, partner." Remember, President Biden, I wasn't talking about you. There's no need to unleash your dinosaur friends from back in elementary school back at me. And Mr. Roosevelt, I don't need your mustache wax. I'm good. Until next segment, keep your spurs jingling and your coffee strong.
Remember, Liberty's flame burns brightest in the darkest hours. Stay tuned to the Modern Federalist.
As we close today's enlightening conversation, I would like to extend my deepest gratitude to E.J. Antoni for joining us and sharing his invaluable insights on inflation and the crises facing America's fiscal and monetary policies. In the spirit of growth and excellence, I would like to tease a bit the exciting expansion of the Modern Federalist. We'll talk about this more in future episodes. Yet, rest assured, our commitment to quality remains unwavering. For we will not sacrifice the substance that defines us for mere numbers. Let us part today with reflection on the words inscribed at the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, a reminder of the enduring principles that guide our nation. Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that His justice cannot sleep forever. In times like these, when the world may seem to be spiraling out of control, remember God's justice will not sleep forever. Together, we stand for justice, for truth, and for the indomitable spirit of America. We are the torchbearers of hope, the guardians of liberty, and the architects of a just and prosperous future. Thank you for tuning in to the Modern Federalist. Until next time, keep the flame of justice burning bright. This is Charlton Allen signing off for now.
Thanks for tuning in to the Modern Federalist. Don't forget to subscribe for more thought-provoking episodes. Until next time.